Hello, this is Monica Reeds and I'm Georgina Godwin. Now, we are in the middle of a series of programmes looking ahead to Hay Festival, one of the biggest and best literary events in the world. It's taken place annually since 1987, and this year it will be online from the 26th of May to the 6th of June, broadcasting the world's greatest writers and thinkers for free from Hay-on-Wye, the small town on the border of Wales. And Monica Reeds and Meet the Writers will be there, bringing you highlights from the festival and interviews with the participants. Well, this week, I want to tell you a little bit about the Strand, marking 300 years since Great Britain appointed its first Prime Minister. This series of PM 300 panels explores issues of leadership and the global crisis of democracy. It was put together by Adrian Lambert, who's the Chief of Staff at Hay. Welcome, Adrian.
Hi there. What
inspired this series on the Prime Ministers?
Well, I guess the most obvious answer first is the fact it's the 300th anniversary of the British Prime Minister this year. So there had been a number of publications to mark that, which is Anthony Seldon's book, The Impossible Job. Steve Richards had written a terrific book as well about that. So there was the obvious kind of historic exploration of the 300th anniversary. But also I think it was about, I think, what caught sort of our imagination is because of the age we live in and the challenges to democracy we're facing, and whether that was through Trump and the assault on the Capitol, or whether that's because of things that are happening in Russia, seeing that Navalny imprisoned, or in China with the sort of global disinformation about and censorship about the fallout of COVID, things we're seeing happen in India under Modi and Bolsonaro in Brazil, Orban, you know, Lukashenko in Belarus. There seem to be a whole series of different things that are challenging us all about democracy and leadership right now. So It seemed a really kind of perfect moment to try and blend all these things together under a series, which is led by this idea of it being the celebration of the 300th anniversary of the British Prime Minister. But in actual fact, it's kind of spilled out into so many different conversations and discussions that we'll be having at Hay.
And not just a look back at the history, a look to the future and perhaps how to fix it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've got some fantastic speakers lined up. You know, Anne Applebaum is doing the Christopher Hitchens lecture, Twilight of Democracy. And that's really looking at the kind of problems we have with some of the digital platforms in the world, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Googles, if you like, and how, in actual fact, people are drawn to these platforms and set against one another, and how, if, you know, how does that breed a conversation between people who take radically opposing views? So, and how do we combat that? How do we look at that problem? I know, for example, it's quite interesting. In there's a Vermont-based website called Front Porch Forum, I think it's called, where the residents of a community go online, but they have to put things up for 24 hours and wait 24 hours before you can respond. And there's kind of really interesting ideas which are filtering around the world, I think, in reaction to that, all that, oh, that's kind of that stuff we've seen. And Mark Carney as well is looking at, from his book Values, is looking at the things we value the most from our frontline nurses, which obviously have been hugely important during the COVID epidemic, to caring for children. And then we've got Gordon Brown as well, who's giving the Raymond Williams lecture, and he's talking about, in from his book and his point of view, seven ways to change the world, and outlining seven challenges, which are global health, climate change, nuclear proliferation, global financial instability, humanitarian crisis, and global poverty, and the barriers to education. So it's a really interesting time, I think, to be talking about these new ideas, you know. So it's, it's kind of interesting in Joe Biden the other day to Congress, you know, where he said we have to prove democracy still works. And, you know, we need to play our part. And I think it's really, really vital. So hopefully some of these conversations and lectures we'll be having at Hay will be partly contributing to that.
Absolutely. Now, Bill Clinton once described famously Hay as the Woodstock of the mind. And of course, he was a stellar guest. And some of the names you've just mentioned, Gordon Brown, for instance, fabulously high profile. How do you get those big political names to come to this tiny town in Wales?
Yeah, it's really fascinating, isn't it? I mean, this is obviously the 33rd festival now. So Hay has a very long tradition of attracting some really very high profile speakers over time. And I think you're right mentioning Clinton there. I mean, I've been coming to Hay since it virtually first started. I first kind of came in contact with the festival back in the late 80s. And I remember vividly when Clinton came, and partly because I was standing in the middle of the road with a pint of beer in my hand and ended up being in a lineup and shaking hands with him, which is kind of bizarre, as the person next to me started talking, asking him questions about the West Wing. A quite surreal moment. But I remember that Clinton thing, and that seemed to really change things. So suddenly, it really did put Hay on the map in a different way. And I think since then, I think a lot of people are attracted by the opportunity to come and speak to a very knowledgeable audience, for one, who always ask incredible questions at Hay, and that's what I tend to get. I think it's Ian McEwan said that, you know, I ask the audience at Hay for, you know, at his research. So there's what I find really amazing is that when we're live, back in the old days, as it were, when you get all these people stuck on one field, it's quite extraordinary, I think, just to find all these people on one field. And I think what's really interesting for a lot of them is that they suddenly also find time to talk to one another in the green room or afterwards, or having a drink or a coffee or a glass of wine, whatever it is, and swap ideas. And it becomes very much that, a kind of cauldron of different thoughts and ideas about all sorts of things. So it is fascinating how the festival has managed to do that year on year.
And I mean, even though the festival is online this year, and I'm saying even though, like, that's a bad thing, we'll return to that in a moment, but many of those politicians are actually coming to the studio in Hay. So those conversations, those backstage conversations, can still take place.
Yeah, absolutely. We are able this year we have a very kind of pared down operation where we're actually broadcasting out from Booth's cinema and Booth's yoga room in the centre of Hay. Some people might know Booth's bookshop in Hay. And essentially we've got two studios where we'll be broadcasting out from. But what we've been able to do is for some people, some speakers who can come, who feel able to come, is to actually invite them to Hay and actually deliver their conversation, the lecture in person, and then it'll be broadcast out. So that's been fantastic to be able to do that. And obviously we hope we're on a roadmap back to being fully open at some stage. But it's great that we're able to have some people back live in the flesh, as it were.
But, you know, being digital seems to me to be really quite an advantage. I mean, there must be a lot of benefits in terms of attracting big names.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were probably one of the first big festivals last year, last May, to go online. And it was an incredible time, really. We only had about 3 weeks to turn essentially a live festival into a digital one. And I think we were even surprised ourselves by how popular it was in many ways. And you suddenly enter this kind of this universe. We've always been digital at Hay in a sense, and we've always had our Hay Player archive that people can explore online. But we were amazed by the reaction, and we had people from over 140 countries or something like that registering at one stage to watch stuff online. And what is amazing is the fact that obviously it's some people who would find it difficult to get to Hay because of where they live, and that could be a different country or another part of the UK, or couldn't afford to come down necessarily and find the B&B or find the hotel or wherever it is. Or those people who actually, you know, are travelling from abroad to come, and speakers. And it does enable us to perhaps get some speakers who might ordinarily find it difficult to fit themselves into their, you know, very busy diaries and to come all the way over to a very small town on the English-Welsh borders for, you know, essentially an hour lecture or so. It does enable us to get into their diaries and broadcast them out to the world, which has been, you know, hugely positive. And I think it's something going forward we'll always have now a hybrid festival. I think, you know, we're very keen, obviously, to get back to the live, but I think the digital side of it has been shown by our audiences that we're going to have to provide this kind of similar kind of service. So it's been really, really interesting. And this is our third iteration of a digital festival now. And each time we've fine-tuned it a little bit more and we've changed how we've done things. And this, again, is another little change where we have more people coming to speak live from Hay. So it's been fascinating.
Absolutely. Finally, Adrian, what are you personally looking forward to?
Such a lot. I am really looking forward to Anne Applebaum's lecture, actually. I'm really, really, she's a fascinating writer. I'm really looking forward to that. Really looking forward to Gary Young, again, who is coming to do one of our lectures. Again, I've always enjoyed Gary's writing. He wrote for The Guardian. Pete Perfidis has got a great book out called Broken Greek. And I grew up in Birmingham, and he grew up in another part of Birmingham, roughly during the same sort of time. So a lot of what stuff he's written about really chimes with things I remember. And people like Tom Allen, because he's so funny, and Caitlin Moran, and the great Alistair Campbell as well. So fascinating. Yes, yeah, so lots to look forward to.
And Carol Walker, of course, with her book Lobby Life, I think is going to be fascinating.
Carol is fantastic. And you know what's so amazing about it, and right now, obviously, we're seeing all this stuff happening with the curtain crisis number 10 going on. And I can only imagine what the lobbies are like with all that sort of chatter. And what's amazing about Carol is, you know, her career in Westminster is huge. And it'd be wonderful to hear those stories about the things that we know that they probably go on, but we don't know too much about. So I think, I'm really looking forward to that. And her event, Carol's event with Steve Richards and with Gitto Harry should be really fantastic. Yeah, absolutely.
Adrian Lambert, Chief of Staff at Hay, thank you very much. Well, let's join Carol now. Her book is Lobby Life, as we've heard, Inside Westminster's Secret Society. It's a no-holds-barred insight into the corridors of Westminster and the secretive club of lobby journalists. Now, Carol, you've been at the heart of the political establishment for 2 decades, and this book really exposes the battles at Downing Street to control the news agenda in the past and recently. And of course, it's never been more relevant as the drama surrounding the fallout of the relationship between Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson dominates the headlines. But this isn't a new phenomenon, is it? Take us back to some early examples of squabbles like these.
Well, yes, absolutely. The thing about the lobby is that it is where the lobby journalists, the Westminster journalists, all those political correspondents that you read in your newspapers and see on screen, are able to roam around the corridors of power. And when Parliament is sitting, twice a day, they get a briefing from the Prime Minister's press secretary. And this is where those battles to control the agenda and to control the narrative really are fought out. The historian Peter Hennessy described it to me as the battle over the first draft of history. And if you think back to the early days, so the lobby started more than 140 years ago. And in those days, it really was secretive. It's a lot less secretive now than it was. But it was so secretive that there were actually rules that told people, do not talk about lobby briefings. You know, you must not allow yourself to be overheard discussing that you have even attended a lobby briefing. And the other key thing about them was that they were completely unattributable. Nowadays, people will read stories and they'll hear, oh, the Prime Minister's spokesperson said this. So you'll know where that line is coming from. Back in the early days, they were completely unattributable. So stories would just appear as a statement of fact. And I think perhaps one of the most extraordinary episodes in this is in the days when Neville Chamberlain was Prime Minister in the run-up to the Second World War. And as people listening will recall, his policy was one of appeasement. He wanted to negotiate a settlement to keep Britain out of the war. And he would brief lobby correspondents in person. That's something that doesn't happen very often these days. The Prime Minister would gather together with what was then a very select band of newspaper journalists. And he would tell them, well, the negotiations are going really well. There is huge optimism on the international scene. There is a real optimism about peace across Europe. Britain will never have to go into another war. And stories along these lines would appear in reputable newspapers, such as The Times, completely unattributably, as though this was a statement of the international situation, rather than, of course, Chamberlain's own propaganda efforts.
And I mean, this is all changing now because, of course, politicians can engage directly with voters via social media. So what is the role of the press and particularly the lobby journalists now?
Well, it has changed a huge amount, and in a way, those lobby briefings are clearly not what they were in those days. These days, it will tend to be from the Prime Minister spokesperson. Of course, there was a proposal that some of the briefings were going to be televised. We were going to have Allegra Stratton in a swish new multi-million pound studio briefing us. But I think they realised the dangers of that and dropped the idea. But it's interesting that it still does have a big influence on the political agenda. These days, yes, you're right that most politicians tweet out their innermost thoughts immediately. The Prime Minister has his own Twitter feed, as does the Leader of the Opposition, and so on. But the lobby journalists are not only speaking to these official channels, they're talking to the rebels, they're talking to the discontented Conservative MPs or the SNP MPs who are working up an amendment where they can get cross-party support. So they can give the wider political context and agenda. And indeed, those words that are uttered by the Prime Minister's spokesperson at a lobby briefing are now tweeted out rapidly as soon as the briefing ends, when they're supposed to wait until then to actually tweet them out, although that rule has also been eroded a bit. Mm-hmm. And so they still can play a huge role in establishing the political narrative of the day.
And I mean, there have been a number of rows recently about journalists, particularly for state broadcasters, becoming too close, for instance, to the Prime Minister. I'm speaking here really of Laura Kunzberg of the BBC, who's been widely criticised for that. Do you think that that is a danger?
Throughout the lobby's history, there have been claims that political journalists, the lobby, it's just a club, they're all too close, they're all absolute patsies, they're just swallowing the government line and regurgitating it. Well, I can tell you that having worked there for more than 20 years and worked at the BBC for throughout that time, there is no way that the journalists are simply accepting what they are told. Often these lobby briefings can be hugely confrontational. There are accusations that the lobby can work as a pack. And yes, journalists do sometimes get together after a lobby briefing and think, what do we think was the most significant line out of that? And perhaps that is a danger. Perhaps there is a danger that journalists get too involved with one another. But when it comes to challenging the government, they can also work as a pack. So you'll get one journalist asking the Prime Minister spokesperson, as I'm sure they're doing at the moment, for example, you know, where did the money come for the flat refurbishment at number 10, and others will follow up with detailed questions about the precise source of the money. And so there is a strength in the lobby as well. And I think if you look at what you see here and read in our newspapers, yes, of course, there will be accusations that some journalists are too close to one side or another of the argument. But I think what we have collectively is a really broad range of political reporting and stories which appear every day on the BBC and elsewhere, which are not what the government want. And I think that is the proof that these political journalists are not simply the patsies of the government.
Mm. What about the structure of the book? Because I know it took a huge amount of research and you actually sat down and had interviews with a broad range of people.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what was really interesting is that, of course, I talked to journalists and I talked to historians and I went to the parliamentary archives to look back through the lobby records, which was a fascinating process in itself. But what was really interesting was hearing what it's like to be on the other side of the fence, the previous men largely and a few women who have briefed on behalf of the Prime Minister. And all of them, and they include people like Gus O'Donnell, who's now a very eminent figure, went on to become the most senior civil servant in the land. Sir Christopher Mayer, who also briefed on behalf of John Major when he was Prime Minister, who went on to be British ambassador to the United States. All of them, with the possible exception of Alistair Campbell, describe it as an utterly terrifying experience because you have assembled in front of you some of the most senior, experienced political correspondents in the land. They've got their own contacts. They know what people are saying behind the scenes. They can ask as many questions as they like, as many follow-ups as they like. There'll be some newcomers who are keen to kind of make their own name as well. And much as a press secretary can try to get across every single story that's on the government agenda, can try to, of course, decide what the main line is that they want to put out. When you're surrounded by journalists or facing up to those journalists, it's not always easy. They also brief, for example, after Prime Minister's question time. It's a more informal gathering in the gallery just above the Commons chamber. And I remember talking to Theresa May's former press secretary, who said he'd got all his vital comments written down, but he realised that the journalists were assembled around him, so he couldn't even pull them away from his chest long enough to read the vital notes he'd written, because they all had messages like, do not say this. So I think one of the most fascinating experiences of putting together this book was hearing from that side of the perspective as well. And certainly when you talk to them, none of them feel that they were simply able to dole out lines to a willing group of lobby hacks.
Excellent stuff. It's such an interesting book. And your session at Hay, you're doing that one. You're also in conversation with a number of other people. And it's all part of the PM 300 series. And people can find out much more about that series at the Hay Festival website. Carol, your book is Lobby Life Inside Westminster's Secret Society. When is it published?
It's published on June the 24th by Elliot and Thompson. And yeah, it's the first book I've ever written, Georgina. It's been a fascinating but a tough experience. So I just hope people will enjoy it.
I'm quite sure that they will. Carol Walker, thank you very much indeed. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, produced by Nora Hull and presented by me, Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.